This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 2, The Global Dimension. They're at it again. Front page headline of the New York Times, September 6, 2009. New exotic investments emerging on Wall Street. By Jenny Anderson. After the mortgage business imploded last year, she writes, Wall Street investment banks began searching for another big idea to make money. They think they may have found one. The bankers plan to buy life settlements, life insurance policies that ill and elderly people sell for cash. $400,000 for a $1 million policy, depending on the life expectancy of the insured person. They plan to securitize these policies by packaging hundreds or thousands together into bonds. They will then resell these bonds to investors like big pension funds who will receive the payouts when people with the insurance die. The earlier the policyholder dies, the bigger the return. Though if people live longer than expected, investors could get poor returns or even lose money. Either way, Anderson writes, Wall Street would profit by pocketing sizable fees for creating the bonds, reselling them, and subsequently trading them. Again, the title, New Exotic Investments Emerging on Wall Street. Haven't we heard this before, Ralph?
Well, Maya, what we're learning here in the New York Times is the confirmation of what is the heart and soul of capitalism, notably finance capital in this late stage of decaying capital, where the productive forces are no longer pursued even nominally, as opposed to speculation on paper. Now, and again, a repeat of the phenomenon known as the toxic loans that were being made to people, the loans that were foisted upon people with an inability to meet the interest payments that would accrue in a short order of time. The same scam, the same scheme is being repackaged now with respect to life insurance. What does it mean? It's predicated on the ability to con the elderly into cashing out their life insurance policies. Cashing them out so that the purchaser of the life insurance policy can then speculate upon the yield it would give. And then they will package those papers and trade those papers and speculate upon the ever-increasing amount of that yield. But what is it predicated upon? It's predicated upon exploiting the elderly. This is, again, pursuing profit in bundles of life insurance at the expense of the population involved, and with a boondoggle of speculation that will collapse as the debt arising from it is shown to be without any hard core collateral base.
Ralph, the banks, as Anderson writes, are seeking to replicate the model of the subprime mortgage securities, which became popular after rating agencies bestowed on them the comfort of a top-tier AAA rating. Let me explain. Subprime mortgage securities are like the junk bonds, the bonds of corporations that were very low grade, as opposed to AAA rating bonds that the pension funds and other institutional investors keep on hand as their investments. But a junk bond or a subprime mortgage security would have a very low rating. So the investment houses bundle up, consolidate the subprime mortgage, that is the risky loans, with better loans. And they created a bundle which these rating agencies then gave top-tier AAA rating. Well, that's the same thing that would happen with these life insurance policies. Physicists are working along with investment bankers to come up with complex mathematical formulas, as you had with the derivatives Mr. Terrell, who's the co-head of Bear Stearns' Longevity and Mortality Desk, which traded in unrated portfolios of life settlements, this is the trading of life insurance policies, to date, they hadn't been rated. He thinks that the securitized life policies have big potential because investors will want to, quote, spread their risks. So they're constantly looking for new investments that do not move in tandem with other investments. In other words, the life settlements will not move in tandem with the rest of the economy because they're based on people's life expectancies. The solution, according to the rating agencies, quote, a bond made up of life settlements that would ideally have policies from people with a range of diseases, leukemia, lung cancer, heart disease, breast cancer, and diabetes, Alzheimer's. That is because if too many people with leukemia are in the securitization portfolio and a cure is developed, the value of the bond would plummet. Yes, it is real, and it's already been done. Ralph.
Here's how it's structured. The idea is still in the planning stages, but already our phones have been ringing off the hook, says Kathleen Tilwitz, Senior Vice President at DBRS, which gives risk ratings to investments and is reviewing 9 proposals for packaging life insurance securitizations from private investors and financial firms, including Credit Suisse. Quote, we hope to get a herd stampeding after the first offering, said one investment banker. In the aftermath of the financial meltdown, exotic investments dreamed up by Wall Street got much of the blame, deservedly. It was not just subprime mortgage securities, but an array of bizarre products, the article continues in the New York Times. Credit default swaps, structured investment vehicles, collateralized debt obligations on which paper speculation was based, with future trading added in that, as the New York Times describes it, proved far riskier than anticipated. The debacle, continues the Times, gave financial wizardry a bad name generally, but not on Wall Street. Even as Washington debates increased financial regulation, the bankers are scurrying around to concoct new and even more bizarre products. In addition to securitizing life settlements, banks are repackaging their money-losing securities into higher-rated ones called re-remix, re-securitization of real estate mortgage investment conduits. It's the same packaging, repackaging, of the bad mortgages that they foisted on people that went sour, which caused the subprime crisis. Morgan Stanley says at least $30 billion of residential remix have already been done this year. Now, the response in the New York Times is interesting. Some are dismayed by Wall Street's quick return to its old ways, chasing profits with complicated new invented products. That's bittersweet, said James D. Cox, a professor of corporate and securities law. The sweet part is that there are investors interested in such exotic products created by underwriters who make huge fees and rating agencies who get paid to confer the ratings. The bitter part is that it's a return to the good old days.
Ralph, it's interesting to look at the life insurance business in the United States. It's a $26 trillion business. There are $26 trillion of life insurance policies in force in the United States. The New York Times notes that even if a small fraction of policyholders sell them, some in the industry predict the market could reach $500 billion, and this would help offset the loss of revenue in Wall Street from the collapse of the residential securities market. For years, people have been cashing in their life insurance policies, and there are many investigations of the firms that con people into doing so. Of course, once you've cashed in your life insurance policy, your family, your heirs, do not have this money after your death. Ralph.
Look, Maya, it's a scam. Here's the New York Times. What is good for Wall Street is bad for the insurance industry and for the customers, too. That's because the policy holders often let their life insurance lapse before they die for a variety of reasons. Their children grow up and no longer need the financial protection, or the premiums have become too expensive for people to afford as they lose their jobs, as their investments and their pension funds, precisely because of these very bank scandals, are deprived of all value. They lose everything. When that happens, the insurer no longer has to make a payout. But if the policy is purchased and packaged into a security package, investors will keep paying the premiums that might otherwise have been abandoned. As a result, more policies will stay in force, ensuring more payouts over time. When they set their premiums, they are basing them on assumptions that were wrong, said Neil Dougherty, a professor at Wharton. Indeed, Dougherty says that in reaction to widespread securitization, insurers will raise the premiums on the new life policy. This defeats the idea of what life insurance is supposed to be, said Stephen Weisbart, the senior vice president and chief economist of the Insurance Information Institute. This is not an investment product. This is a gambling product. I just want to bring this point that we've been discussing to a conclusion, because it's important to note that the New York Times itself is clearly frightened about all the implications of this. Quote, even if a small fraction of policyholders do sell them, the industry predict the market will reach immediately $500 billion. This industry, writes the New York Times, has been plagued with fraud. State insurance regulators, hamstrung by a patchwork of laws and regulations, are criticizing these life settlement brokers for coercing the ill and elderly to take out policies with the sole purpose of selling them back to brokers called, quote, stranger-owned life insurance. And the meaning of this is, quote, the challenge for Wall Street is to make securitized life insurances more predictable and usable investments. The banks are seeking to replicate the model of subprime mortgage securities, which became popular after rating agencies bestowed upon the comfort of a top-tier AAA rating, arbitrarily. An individual mortgage to a home buyer with poor credit might have been considered risky, but packaging lots of mortgages limited risk, the theory went, and so all of these toxic products were packaged and given the highest ratings. They're going to repeat the same thing with insurance. Could a way be found to protect against fraud by agents buying insurance policies and reselling them? The Times asks. How could they make sure that the policies were legally sellable? They can't. To understand the risks, Ms. Tilwitz and her colleague, a mathematics whiz with a PhD in nuclear engineering, traveled to visiting firms that handle these settlements. What are we looking at here? A bond made up of life settlements based upon leukemia, lung cancer, heart disease, breast cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, the speculation upon the ailments from which people suffer, the deprivation of the means of financing the cure or even the handling of disease or their old age. That's capitalism in a nutshell. And they are pursuing precisely what they did with the home security markets, now with the lives of people at risk.
Now, let's go on to the global dimension. Last week, we discussed the enormous bailout of U.S. banks, and particularly studied the 19 largest bank holding companies, which hold two-thirds of all banking assets in the United States. We mentioned that $10 trillion of these assets are at risk, $8.9 trillion from the credit default sub-investment grade derivatives. Among these banks, Bank of America, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, each of them have more than $10 billion of exposure. Let's look at Europe. Bank Street is the title of an amazing graphic and compilation of articles prepared in the Financial Times, October 10, 2008, by Sky Daugherty, Stephen Bernard, and Carolyn Nevitt. Let's look at some of the government work that was done throughout Europe to prop up the capitalist banking system. It began with Northern Rock, September 14, 2007. The UK United Kingdom lender was forced to seek liquidity support from the Bank of England. This precipitated its collapse and the eventual nationalization of Northern Rock, a very large mortgage lender. It cost the British government $42 billion. It was followed shortly, on October 2nd, when UBS announced that it would take a 4 billion Swiss franc write-down on subprime mortgages. This drove a rally in the markets because investors felt that the banks were recognizing the problem, and they thought that UBS wouldn't be facing the magnitude of the problems of Northern Rock. However, a year later, the Swiss government agreed to take on most of UBS's toxic debts and inject $5.3 billion to recapitalize the bank. Again, a bank that was too big to fail. The next month, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, another United Kingdom bank, announced that it was going to have its own bailout of one of its investment properties, a $45 billion bailout of its own emerging markets. HSBC was able to handle this because its own assets are $2.55 trillion. Soon after, in France, Société Générale was rocked by a huge loss. This was caused by a trading scandal by one of its prime investment brokers. Credit Suisse, another Swiss bank, announced that it was going to have $2.85 billion in write-downs as a result of so-called pricing errors. It couldn't handle it. And in October, after it had declined a government bailout, Credit Suisse went to Qatar's sovereign wealth fund and the Olayan family of Saudi Arabia and Israel's core industry to get an enormous multi-billion dollar bailout. This was just the beginning. It all continued into 2008. Ralph?
Well, Maya, there are the sovereign wealth funds, a state-owned investment fund composed of financial assets like stocks and bonds and property and precious metals and other financial instruments. And the largest sovereign wealth funds had their origin in non-oil revenue. The accumulated funds had their origin in foreign currency deposits, gold, SDRs, the International Monetary Fund reserve positions held by central banks, along with other national assets, pension investments, industrial and financial holdings, which obliterates national boundaries and nominal sovereignty because the regimes in place, whether it's in China, whether it's in Singapore, whether it's in Hong Kong, whether it's in Russia, they are submitted to the speculations of banking capital. The assets under the management of sovereign wealth funds reached $3.8 trillion in 2008, trillions upon trillions of dollars in these holdings, subject to the completely arbitrary fate of such mechanisms as we've been describing to date.
Ralph, the sovereign wealth funds became a source of bailout for the international financial system. The term sovereign wealth fund was coined in 2005 by an economist. Previously, these were the foreign reserves and the holdings of the rich oil emirates. The largest sovereign wealth funds are derived from oil revenue, except for those in China, Singapore, and Hong Kong, which come from commodity sales. As we saw, the sovereign wealth funds were tapped by Credit Suisse, but they were also tapped by other large banks throughout the world. Let's go now to the United States, which we've discussed with Bear Stearns, the collapse of Bear Stearns, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and then the changing of U.S. banking laws, which we've discussed on prior shows. What happened to Lehman Brothers? It's very interesting. This failure was caused when Lehman Brothers, on September 14th, 2007, filed for bankruptcy protection because the Japanese banks, which were its top unsecured lenders, refused to let Lehman Brothers take money out of Japan. They said to Lehman Brothers that you had to retain the assets that were in Japan. Thus, Lehman Brothers couldn't shift that capital to other parts of the company. When Lehman Brothers failed, it's interesting that its assets were then bought up throughout Asia. In September of 2008, Nomura bought Lehman Brothers' Asian operations and then also bought its European and Middle Eastern equities and corporate finance. $257 billion of assets. Ralph?
Well, it goes on from Morgan Stanley, which after became a regulated bank after the Federal Reserve approved its application as a bank holding company, the bank gained access to emergency funds, $1.03 trillion in assets. WaMu, the biggest bank failure in U.S. history. Assets of $307 billion, total deposits of $188 billion. Its failure far surpassed that of the SNL closures. $19 billion estimate of bad debts alone. Then there's Fortis, the largest European financial institution, had to be bailed out. Three European governments threw the bank $11.2 billion euro lifeline after the attempts to sell a part of the group to Paribas broke down. It's endless. It's a cyclical, all-enveloping, incestuous relationship of speculators that compete with each other for how much they can grab and then cause each ad seriatim to go into catastrophic collapse.
Something that's happened in Europe that hasn't yet happened in the United States but is on the horizon, according to the Congressional Oversight Panel, is the bailout with respect to commercial property and public sector lenders. And there were large bailouts in Europe already. Hypo Real Estate Group, one of Europe's biggest commercial property and public sector lenders, was handed a $35 billion euro liquidity lifeline by other German private sector banks, the Bundesbank, which is the German National Bank, the European Central Bank, amid a liquidity crisis. On October 5, 2008, Germany raised the aid to $68 billion. And then in England, Bradford and Bingley, a UK rental property lender, which is called in the UK buy to let, was nationalized after the retail savers withdrew tens of millions of pounds. The purchase deal hammered out with Santander, the large Spanish bank Grupo Santander, which bought the deposits of the 2.7 million customers for Bradford and Bingley and its branch network, while the government retained the risky mortgages and consumer loans. Ralph?
Well, Maya, as you say, as in Europe, as in on the global scale, so again in the United States. Here's the Miami Herald, August 25th. Wall Street repackages unappealing debt. Wall Street may have discovered a way out from under the bad debt and risky mortgages that have climbed the financial markets. This would-be solution sounds familiar. It's a lot like what got banks into trouble in the first place. In recent months, investment banks have been repackaging the old mortgage securities and selling them as new products, a plan that's nearly identical to the complicated investment packages at the heart of the market's collapse. This is a bit of deja vu, and it's grave, said Arizona State University economics professor Herbert Kaufman. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose.
Ralph, one of the biggest bailouts was the entire banking system in Iceland, and it started in September 2008 when the Icelandic bank took control of Glitnir, the third largest bank, after a squeeze on short-term funding sparked fears of liquidity crisis. This cost Iceland $864 million, but it didn't stop there. That was September 29th. Just a few days later, October 7th, Landsbanki, Iceland's second largest bank, was nationalized as the country used new powers to allow it to seize control of public companies in the financial service sector. Iceland changed its banking laws in order to take control of these banks. So first we had the third largest bank, then we had the nationalization of the second largest bank. One day later, October 8th, Kaupthing, Iceland's largest lender, was nationalized after a collapse in confidence in the country and its banking system. The investors not only lost confidence in individual bank, they lost confidence in the entire country of Iceland. The bank asked Iceland's financial supervisory authority to take control, and this happened not as a result of what was going on in banking in Iceland, but as a result of a UK subsidiary, Kaupthing, Singer and Friedlander, which is a stock brokerage, and it had been placed into administration by the British government. Here we have the country taking control, nationalizing its banking system in order to keep up the financial liquidity of the country. Ralph?
Mind you, that nationalization, Maya, is in name only, because what in essence they were doing was utilizing the nation's assets to subsidize the failing banks while the bankers called the shots. The pattern is clear globally, not just in the United States. Dexia, the Franco-Belgian bank, received a $6.4 billion euro cash injection from the Belgian, French, and Luxembourg governments after its shares lost 30% of their value. It was the second time in 24 hours that the Belgian government saved the bank after the partial so-called nationalization of Fortis with the Dutch and Luxembourg governments. Again, with BNP Paribas and Fortis, the French bank, BNP Paribas, one of the largest in the world, agreed to buy the Belgian government's assets in Fortis and took control of the bank, which made BNP the largest bank in the eurozone. The accumulated deposits arising from this, $2.48 trillion. And ING, the Dutch banking insurance group, received 10 billion in euro government injection to shore up its core capital as it began to fail. In return, the government had to buy a new class of securities that count towards ING's core, $1.85 trillion in assets. And then we have, of course, Citigroup in the United States, where the U.S. government rescued Citigroup to backstop $306 billion in problematic assets and injecting another $20 billion in capital 2 months after Citigroup's $2.2 billion purchase of Wachovia banking operations displaced Wells Fargo's attempt to do the same. It is a sick and continuing global process of capitalism in rapid and terminal decay.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 2, The Global Dimension. Ralph, I'd like to turn now to further discussion of the global dimension, and particularly the Great European Bubble. It was discussed very well in an article, Entering the Greatest Depression, the Bailout Bubble, by Andrew Gavin Marshall, August 7, 2009, Global Research. He writes, in October of 2008, Germany and France led a European Union bailout of 1 trillion euros. World markets initially soared as European governments pumped billions into crippled banks. Central banks in Europe also mounted a new offensive to restart lending by supplying unlimited amount of dollars to commercial banks in a joint operation. This information comes from the Times Online, October 13, 2008. And Ralph, you showed me an article of February 11, 2009 from The Telegraph, which published a story with the headline, European Banks May Need 16.3 trillion pound bailout.
Yes, Maya. Well, in particular, what we should note here is that the Daily Telegraph published a very important but secret EC document. It was a secret 17-page paper which had been discussed by finance ministers of the European community, including the Chancellor, Alistair Darling. And in this document, the estimates of total expected asset write-downs indicated that they would reach the scale of 16 trillion pounds sterling, which is over $25 trillion, brothers and sisters. The full magnitude of this is that The $23.7 trillion that Neil Barofsky, who is the Special Inspector General of SICTARP, the nominal overseer who reported to Congress that the $23.7 trillion and counting are the real amount of the concealed bailout, the numbers never being fully disclosed. And what's instructive about Barofsky's extraordinary testimony before Congress, which the press has tried to downplay or ignore, is that he said the $23.7 trillion is not the total number. It only represents what I've been able to document and get my hands on. And here we have this disclosure from the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Alistair Darling of the UK, that in a secret 17-page paper, that the total expected asset write-downs on the European side are $25 trillion. We're talking now about $50 trillion of bailout, of subsidization of the speculator banks. The enormity of this is that there is no way that the outcome, the fallout, the extraordinary extrapolation from this deficit-based underwriting of toxic banks will ever be recovered. There's no way that the continued speculation on which the banking sector of capital is based will stop, or that the outcome, the outfall, will not be of even greater magnitude, which is, of course, the basis for the appropriate title of the article that you'd cited, The Greatest Depression in History, is about to unfold.
Ralph, we should discuss Eastern Europe, because the Eastern European countries were in desperate need of financial aid. And the issue was whether the other European countries would bail them out. As he writes, when Eastern European countries were in desperate need of financial aid and discussion was heated on the possibility of an EU, that's a European Union, bailout of Eastern Europe, the EU, at the behest of Angela Merkel of Germany, denied the Eastern Europe bailout. However, this was more a public relations stunt than an actual policy position. And I disagree with him. It's not a public relations stunt. It's a question of what pressure you put on Eastern Europe so that the economy of Eastern Europe does not compete with the German economy. While the European Union refused money to Eastern Europe in the form of a bailout, the International Monetary Fund lending facility put up 75 billion euros to supply the Eastern European countries. But this money has stringent requirements. The EU leaders, quote, agreed to increase funding for the balance of payment support to Eastern European members. They doubled it from 25 billion euros to 50 billion euros. But along with this are the strings. The strings, more austerity for these countries. The impending bankruptcy of Central European homeowners and their businesses, more austerity coming through the International Monetary Fund. Ralph.
Maya, I agree with you. Andrew Gavin Marshall's article, Entering the Greatest Depression in History, More Bubbles Waiting to Burst, is in the large a very important and useful compilation. But I don't think he's correct in his assessment of some of the material on which he bases himself. To give a concrete example along the lines you were indicating, in the important expose in the Daily Telegraph by Waterfield, the European banks may need £16 trillion bailout. Here's how the secret 17-page paper that was reported upon discusses what you were raising. National leaders and European Union officials share fears that the second bank bailout in Europe will raise government borrowing at a time when investors who lend money to the European governments have growing doubts over the ability of countries such as Spain, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Britain to pay back. The Commission figure is significant because of the role European Union officials will play in devising rules to evaluate these toxic bank assets later this month. The new moves to bail out the banks to be discussed at the Emergency European Union Summit finds the European Union deeply worried at the widening spreads on the bonds sold by the different European countries. There's nothing about public relations here. This is a core crisis that goes to the heart of the speculative bailouts that are rapidly in place. And you mentioned Latvia here. If the crisis expands, other European Union governments will face the existential question, do they commit hundreds of billions of euros to guarantee the debts of fellow EU countries, or do they allow government defaults and devaluations that will break up the single currency, cripple German industry, and the country's domestic banks? Publicly, German politicians insist that the bailouts are out of the question. However, the pass has been quietly sold in Brussels, even as the politicians loudly protest their unshakable commitment to defend it. Now, another consequence of these bailouts is the following. The Financial Times pointed it out in August 2009. Bank failures or plunging currencies in the three Baltic nations, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, threaten the fragile prospect of any recovery in the rest of Europe. These countries sit on the world's most sensitive political fault lines. They are the European Union's frontier states bordering Russia. Latvia had agreed its second loan in 8 months from the International Monetary Fund. And what's important about that, brothers and sisters, as the Financial Times points out, is that the injection of cash on the basis of the International Monetary Fund requirements will obligate the Latvian government to impose what is called by the Financial Times yet more pain on its suffering population. Public sector wages have already been cut by a third, pensions have been sliced, and now the INF will require Latvia to cut another 10% from its state budget this autumn. What we're talking about here is not merely $25 trillion in bad bank assets. We're talking about a bubble that is yet to blow, $50 trillion between the European Union and the United States waiting to burst, while the condition of all these bailouts is the vast and intensive pauperization of the populations concerned. Not just in Latvia, not just in Estonia, not just in Lithuania, not just in Germany, not just in Great Britain, but in particular across the United States. You watch, brothers and sisters, as all of the social services, all of the so-called public funding for pensions and for health care will be scrubbed, will be scrapped, will be rolled back as a crisis of unparalleled dimensions afflicts working people in the United States and across the world.
Ralph, let's return to a discussion that we started last week. While the 19 large bank holding companies hold two-thirds of all banking assets, we still need to look at the other banks that have one-third of all banking assets. There are between 7,900 and 8,500 banks. 350 of these banks, aside from the 19 bank holding companies, the very large ones that the government has said are too big to fail, also received capital infusions under TARP. The next wave of problems, according to the Congressional Oversight Panel, is the commercial mortgage market, which accounts for $6.7 trillion of accounts, 10% of the U.S. GDP. The defaults, or the near defaults, on these commercial securities is up 41% since 2008. These are then the commercial securities and the loans, the commercial loans. 54% of commercial loans moved from delinquent to default. And many of these loans have been securitized as CMBS, commercial mortgage-based securities, which are held by the very large banks, but the loans themselves are held by these regional, small, and mid-sized banks. The Wall Street Journal did an important study that is cited in the Oversight Panel's report. Local banks face big losses. So I went to the original article, and it is quite revealing. May 19, 2009, Morris Tamman and David Enrich, and they write, commercial real estate loans could generate losses of $100 billion by the end of next year at more than 900 small and mid-sized U.S. banks. Such loans, which fund the construction of shopping malls, office buildings, apartment complexes, and hotels, account for nearly half the losses at banks analyzed by the journal, consuming capital that's an essential cushion against bad loans. Total losses, in fact, at these banks could surpass $200 billion over the period. Ralph?
Well, under that scenario, Maya, over 600 small and mid-sized banks will see their capital shrink to levels considered absolutely catastrophic by federal regulators. The potential losses will exceed revenue over that period at all the banks analyzed by the Wall Street Journal. The potential losses on commercial real estate are by far, the journal writes, the largest problem facing mid-sized and small banks, easily exceeding losses on home loans, which will total initially $49 billion, according to the Wall Street Journal. One-third of the banks will see their capital slip to risk levels because of commercial real estate losses. Using data contained in the bank filings with the Federal Reserve and examining the financial health of 940 small and mid-sized banks, applying loan loss criteria that the Fed used in its stress test of the largest banks, these findings are what the journal calls a stark reminder that the U.S. banking industry's problems stretch far beyond the 19 giant banks scrutinized in the government stress tests. Regulators and investors have focused on too-big-to-fail banks, but more than 8,000 other lenders throughout the country are being squeezed by the recession, by the real estate crash, and by the pending collapse of the commercial market. Quote, they are in just much worse shape than the big banks, said Terry McAvoy, an Oppenheimer and Company analyst who reviewed the journal's analysis. There is a lot less earning power at these banks.
Ralph, the journal prepared an interesting graph, stressed out potential losses through 2010 at 940 U.S. bank holding companies by type of loan. The largest potential losses, commercial real estate, $99.4 billion. Commercial industrial, $28.9 billion. Credit cards and other loans, $28.2. First lien mortgages, home mortgages, $26.8. And then second lien mortgages, this is home equity mortgages, $22.1 billion for a total of $205.7 billion. Ralph?
Yes, Maya. The Wall Street Journal again on August 28th. The banks on the sick list top 400. This is an article by Damian Paletta and again David Enrich. The banking industry continues to deteriorate, with federal regulators adding 111 bank lenders to their list of endangered banks in the latest quarter. The government fund that protects consumer deposits fell to its lowest levels since 1993. Despite trillions of dollars in government rescue financing and a nominally rebounding stock market, there are questions that have been raised about how the economy can revive. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said it had 416 banks on its urgent problem list at the end of June, equivalent to 5% of the nation's banks and up from 305 at the end of March and 117 since the end of June. Problem banks had a combined $299.8 billion of assets compared with $78 billion a year before. Quote, it's a continuation of deterioration across the industry, said Gerard Cassidy, a bank analyst with RBC Capital Markets. We think there are hundreds of more failures to come. The FDIC's insurance fund, which guards $6.2 trillion in U.S. deposits, fell to $10.4 billion at the quarter's end. Do you know the meaning of that, brothers and sisters? Deposits of ordinary citizens in banks are not going to be secure. The next round of crash will create a bank run that parallels that of 1929. And that is a confirmed by every study, Financial Times, Bloomberg, Business Week, Wall Street Journal. Here is Gerald Celente. The bailout bubble, the bubble to end all bubbles. This is a very important article. The biggest, he is director of the Trends Research Institute, by the way. The biggest financial bubble in history is being inflated before our eyes and in plain sight. This is the mother of all bubbles, and when it explodes, it will signal the end of any boom-bust cycle that has characterized economic activity in the developed world. Unwilling and unable to call the bubble by its proper name, The media, Washington and Wall Street, describe the stupendous government expenditures, he writes, on rescue packages, stimulus plans, buyouts, and takeovers as emergency measures needed to salvage a severely damaged economy. All of this terminology, states Gerald Celente of Trends Research Institute, all of this terminology is econo-jargon. It's like calling torture enhanced interrogation techniques. Washington is inflating the biggest bubble ever, the bailout bubble, far bigger than the dot-com and real estate bubbles would hit speculators, investors, and financiers the hardest, he writes. However destructive the effects of those busts, unemployment, savings, and productivity was left intact. But when this bailout bubble explodes, the system goes with it. The economic framework of the United States has been restructured. Federal interventionist policies have given the government equity stakes, executive power, and management control of what is called private enterprise. To finance these buyouts, rescue and other packages for failing and bankrupt banks and bandit brokerages that go bankrupt represent trillions of dollars injected into a failing economy. Phantom dollars printed out of thin air, backed by nothing, producing next to nothing, defined the bailout bubble. And just as with the other bubbles, so this too will burst. But unlike the dot-com and the real estate, when this bailout bubble pops, he writes, neither the president nor the Federal Reserve will have the fiscal fixes or the monetary policies available to inflate yet another. With no more massive economic bubbles left to blow up, they'll set their sights on bigger targets. Given the pattern of governments to parlay egregious failure into mega failures, the classic trend they follow when all else fails, take the nation to war, concludes Celente. He writes, the bailout bubble is neither called nor recognized as a bubble. Its sudden and spectacular explosion will create total chaos. A panicked public will accept any Wall Street, Washington, Main Street media alibi to shift the blame for the catastrophe away from the economic system and its policymakers and onto some scapegoat. We are not forecasting a war, but the trends in play are ominous. While we cannot pinpoint exactly the moment when the bailout bubble will burst, we are certain that it will. And when it does, it should be understood a major war will follow. Now, this is no radical. This is no socialist. This is no revolutionist. This is a financial analyst from within the system describing it with brutal accuracy and brutal honesty.
Ralph, with the bailout bubble, it's important again to refer to commercial real estate. Strip malls, neighborhood centers, regional malls are losing stores at the fastest pace in at least a decade as the retailers trim down to stay afloat and as many retailers are closing, reported CNN. In the first quarter of 2009, retail tenants have vacated 8.7 million square feet of commercial space. The vacancy rate at malls rose 9.5% in the first quarter, outpacing the 8.9% vacancy rate of all of 2008. And downtown office vacancies nationwide come close to 15% by the end of last year. That approaches the 10-year high of 15.5% in 2003. I want to turn now to something to which you referred, how the government is saying that there is a recovery when in fact there's a bailout bubble, because it is important not to have a run on the banks. The biggest banking failure in the United States is Washington Mutual, WaMu as it is called. Very large savings and loan, which they call a thrift. More than half of its loans were home equity, adjustable rate mortgages, and subprime. On September 25th, 2008, WaMu became the biggest bank failure in U.S. history when a plunging share price and the outflow of $16.7 billion in deposits, that is, a massive run on the bank, prompted the regulators to take control. WaMu had assets of $307 billion and total deposits of $188 billion. a little less than 10% of those deposits flew out of the bank in just a few days. The failure of WaMu far surpasses that of the 1984 savings and loan closure of the $40 billion Continental Illinois National Bank and Trust Company, which to date had been the largest bank failure. The government took over and sold WaMu to J.P. Morgan Chase for $1.9 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase not only got coast-to-coast banking, it became the largest U.S. credit card business, overtaking Citigroup, Bank of America. This is the story of confidence and why it is important for the federal government to say that recovery is on the agenda. Ralph.
Well, Maya, what you're describing here, as we have indicated in this program, is not merely a North American phenomenon. It is a global one. It is no more graphically demonstrated than in this article by the London Times, The Great Bailout, Europe's Best-Kept Secret. Germany is at the heart of a huge plan to prop up crippled European Union economies, not that the German people would ever know. Europe, writes Anatole Kaletsky in the London Times on July 4th, is in the middle of a perfect storm, a confluence of three separate interconnected economic crises which threaten far greater devastation than Bank Britain or America have suffered from the credit crunch. The collapse of European industry and employment, the impending bankruptcy of central European homeowners and businesses, the threat of government debt defaults from loss of monetary control affects the Irish Republic, Greece, Portugal, the entire Eurozone periphery. Latvia, having followed an Argentine-style policy of fixing its exchange rate and encouraging its citizens to borrow in euros and Swiss francs, is in the front line of the battle between governments and financial markets, a humiliating devaluation to be imposed. Last weekend, a former Swedish finance ministry official brought in by the government as an advisor admitted that devaluation, with its devastating consequences on the population, was no longer a matter of if, but when and how. As Latvia devalues, then what will happen to the two other Baltic states will be that they will be forced to follow. The panic will move to Romania and Hungary. Beyond that, the contagion will spread to the weakest members of the Eurozone, Ireland, Greece, Portugal, and Austria. As the crisis expands, writes the London Times, other European Union governments, and especially Germany, will face an existential question. Do they commit hundreds of billions of euros to guarantee the debts of fellow European Union countries, or do they allow government defaults and devaluations that will break up the single currency, cripple German industry and the country's domestic banks? Brothers and sisters, this is a very important article. It concludes as follows. In the London Times, as the juggernaut of Eurofederalism rolls on with banking bailouts, viewed from an increasingly crisis-ridden Central Europe, the history of Eurofederalism keeps being repeated, but as Karl Marx said, what began as tragedy ends in farce. London Times, concluding with who? Karl Marx, brothers and sisters.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Chimera of Capitalist Recovery, Part 2, The Global Dimension, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. We'll be with you next week.
Biki biki no biniye, tatam tatim la pa.